This is Introductory Modern Physics 2710. The date is the 27th of March 2007. So start off with one of your questions, Teresa, and then we'll give Jacob a shot at superconductivity. And I sent you some websites on paramagnetism and diamagnetism today.
I'll have to look at them. Just one question, just to start with. What kind of a measuring unit is WB? That's how lost I am. What's WB?
Oh.
If I ever knew, I'd forgotten. They're talking about a quantum
fluxoid. Okay. Yeah. And we haven't seen that unit yet, huh? That is the unit of magnetic flux, and it comes in Weber's. W-E-B-E-R. Let's see if they've got them listed anywhere. Weber's.
That sounds familiar. Did I read that last?
They might be in Knight's book.
They were in Knight's book, yeah.
It seems like there's lots of stuff in this book that I haven't learned or even heard of yet, so it makes it really confusing for me.
You guys have an advantage. You're taking all kinds of physics. Like, I'm trying to dredge up something from however many walls. Like, what?
Let's chat about the flux for just a minute. Oh, yeah. Well, we were just going to derive that. But it's at the bottom of this page in our other physics textbook, Teresa. Well, in fact, I was just going to write this stuff up here, so I guess there's no need for me to write it since it's right here. I was just going to define flux as the amount of magnetic field captured or encompassed by a certain amount of area. Sometimes you might think of it as being a loop of wire. It could be a square loop like these are, or it doesn't have to be. It could certainly be round loops, or they don't even really have to be wires actually. But the idea is that you want to compute how much area you have and dot product it with the strength of the magnetic field. So that's what this is showing, is kind of the dot product idea with the angle between them. But that's the definition of flux, is the magnetic field times the area. Of course, you can reword that in terms of what the dot product means this way. But nonetheless, all this does give us the units of what a Weber is actually equal to, because B fields themselves come in Teslas. And then if we're going to, you know, if the B is Teslas and the A is square meters, well, that's where that all comes from. So that's what a Weber is, and I was going to write all that down, okay. But Jacob found it in the book, so I don't have to. Does that help?
Yeah, that helps. I was just looking at it thinking, now, what?
It's page 1050, if anybody has a Knight book they care about. Okay, next question.
Just a chapter 9 thought. I was just thinking about this, and when you're far away from an electron, do you think of it as the Bohr model? Like, I don't know, because they were talking about ferromagnetism and stuff, and that's because they line up.
Oh,
and that kind of thing. Like, that kind of disturbed me how we decided that you can't, it's not the Bohr model, and then we're like, well, to explain this, we're going to use the Bohr model.
You didn't like that at all. I could tell at the time. We abandoned the Bohr model for a more complete description with the Schrodinger equation and the derivations of solutions of that, indicating the wave function, which is a kind of a spread out deal, and even it doesn't tell you much about physical reality until you square it, and even still it only gives you a probability. So we tried to move beyond the Bohr model. I guess the reason I went back to the Bohr model is because you can envision how there might be a little tiny current loop, that one charge being the whole entire current. But it's still true that even though we've moved beyond the Bohr model in terms of our visualization of the hydrogen atom, that you kind of have to carry the thought with you that you can still have a net magnetic moment of the electron around the nucleus and the spin of the electron itself. I mean, we had the same trouble back when we first introduced the idea of spin at all, in that it's kind of a classical idea. You think of a spinning ball, and yet we claim that an electron is a fundamental point particle with no size. How can it be a spinning ball when it has zero size? And yet we don't have any better way to think of it, to convince ourselves that there is some spin to it. And yet all the experiments indicate that that's a consistent way and a correct way to talk about it. So even as far as I know, most physics teachers keep thinking of little spinning balls, even though they know they shouldn't, but there's nothing better. And that's kind of the situation with the electron around the atom. We know it's not right. In this case, we know there's something better as far as the overall visualization of the atom, but you still have to carry along the idea that it's going to have a magnetic moment. So we didn't wholesale return to the Bohr model as if it's true, but just to pick up the idea to convince ourselves that we can accept a magnetic moment.
So there's other things going on there. But
yeah. even...
And I can accept that, because it might be over my scope anyway, but...
What's strange is even neutrons have a magnetic moment. And you think of magnetic moments coming from moving charges, right? So we might have to resolve that dilemma in chapter 14. So remind me to tell you why a neutron has a magnetic moment when we get to
it. It has no charge and it's not moving.
Right. Teresa, did you come up with another question?
Yeah, well, maybe you could just deal conceptually with some of the things from superconductors.
Okay.
I mean, because I don't really even understand what I don't even get any kind of picture when they talk about there's a complete expulsion of magnetic flux from within a superconductor. Well, what does that mean? Is there any sort of general way to say why it does it? How come there's no resistance? Is it something to do with energy? You get a kind of feeling that it is, but they don't really say. Because it has no energy to lose? Or, I don't know. I mean, after I read through this, and maybe you're right, it's just like, I'll just have to be happy with my fog.
At some level you will be, but I can help you a little bit with this stuff. And superconductors are fairly important, and they're worth some time, and maybe we can help the fog lift at least a little bit, if not completely. It is an important phenomenon in that we think it's going to have some real practical applications someday. Hasn't had a whole lot yet, but we can make superconducting magnets, which would be very, very strong because you can run a lot of current and you don't have to lose any power to heating up your magnet. If there's no resistance, I squared R is zero. So making electromagnets out of superconducting materials is an attractive thing. And just simply transmitting power long distances without losing a lot of it to heat losses, thermal I squared R, thermal dissipation, would be a wonderful thing too. But that we haven't been willing to pay for, because you would have to cool the transmission wires from Delta to Los Angeles to liquid nitrogen temperatures, and that would be too expensive. But it's still kind of an important thing, and it's also a very surprising thing when we first discovered it. It's not just simply an extension of the idea that the colder a metal gets, the lower its resistance goes. That's generally true, and it's almost kind of even linear. And we saw a demonstration in our other physics class the other day where it was the jumping ring demo, where he put the ring in the nitrogen and it jumped a lot higher because it was 7 times more conducting at liquid nitrogen temperature. So metals tend to have a resistance that's proportional to the absolute temperature. So the colder it gets, the lower the resistance. And that's usually a good thing, and you can put it to good effect. And so maybe you'd kind of expect... maybe you'd expect superconductivity to be an extension of that, but it isn't. It isn't. Superconductivity is not an extension of regular conductivity. It's a totally new phenomenon, which is quite unexpected, because it's not just a continuation of the reduction of resistance. It goes to zero. It drops off suddenly. What page are you on? 337. 337, there's a diagram of the resistance versus temperature, resistivity versus temperature for tin. And at 3.3 Kelvin, the resistance just simply disappears. It doesn't continue to reduce. It's just gone. And I have to stress over and over, because I think this is so amazing that I assume other people think it's pretty amazing too, that we are in no way talking about a small resistance that's just maybe so small that we can't measure it. We think it is, in fact, truly zero, with as many decimal zeros as you want. It's zero. And that's kind of an amazing absolute statement to make. It's not just small. It's zero. And so you have to invent all new kinds of physics to explain this, because classical physics wouldn't explain it going to zero. And in fact, this other curve on the same graph, figure 28, what's that, platinum, shows that it goes colder and colder and colder, but then it levels off, and the resistivity does not go to zero, even at zero Kelvin for non-superconductors. And I think in chapter 11, they also talk some more about
63.
Conductivity.
How do they know that? Because they can't get temperatures as cold as zero Kelvin.
Yeah, the top of page 363, figure 11.1, similar to this, showing that a conductor, the parts A and B of the figure, B is a blow-up of part A, but it's kind of linear, going down, getting smaller and smaller resistivity as the temperature drops, looking in part A of figure 11.1. But then it actually kind of levels off, and so in figure B, that's a blow-up of the last little left-hand portion of figure A, and you see that it reaches a non-zero limiting value. Well, that's a normal conductor. Of course, the point of this in chapter 11 is to talk about semiconductors, and that's part C of the figure, but that's not what we're talking about now. We're talking about the fact that this is not, superconductivity is not related to the phenomenon of regular conductivity. It's truly different. Miles' question is, how do we know this data? We can measure it.
I thought they couldn't get temperatures down to zero. Okay.
They can get them to within a few nanokelvins.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, so we can measure that data. Well, how are we going to explain superconductivity? Well, I kind of let the cat out of the bag even back in Chapter 9. I claimed that it was similar to superfluidity, which is, in some sense, a Bose-Einstein statistics situation, where we're talking about bosons rather than fermions, and therefore don't obey the Pauli exclusion principle. How do you get bosons out of electrons, which are clearly fermions? I mean, the electrons are the current carriers. Go ahead, Teresa.
Well, they pair up.
Yeah.
What you call the Cooper pairs or whatever.
The Cooper pairs. And so a Cooper pair can be thought of as a boson, and bosons don't have to obey the Pauli exclusion principle. And so you can have interesting new phenomena appear that you wouldn't have expected otherwise. It's more complicated than that, and there's no way that I could explain to you all the details of the BCS theory of superconductivity, because I don't know it all myself. I mean, to think of how these electrons would be physically paired up, I mean, sure, you can take a spin-up thing and a spin-down thing and say, okay, they're a boson with no spin, but physically, you're not smashing them together into a new particle. They're still electrons, but they can be separated by fairly decent distances, but somehow they know about each other, and they agree to be friends and partners and to be a pair. And so they can plow through this lattice structure, which prior to that, you know, if you just have one electron at a time banging around, and that's the whole cause of resistance in the first place, is these collisions. And now all of a sudden, if these decide to pair up, they don't collide anymore. They just go through unimpeded. It's pretty amazing. It's kind of a quantum effect and a Bose effect, a boson effect. It's very, very cool.
Sounds like magic.
Well, I think a lot of people would agree. I mean, it looks like that, and I think it was kind of that surprising when it was first discovered. It does seem like magic to have zero resistance in the first place at the macroscopic level, truly zero, but then to try and explain it, it's kind of a magical thing, and I don't think you'd have a chance at explaining it classically. So maybe it's a good thing we didn't discover it in the 1800s, so we would have had no way to figure out how to explain it. Quantum theory came along, and then we were able to at least discuss it. What else is I going to say about superconductivity? You wanted to talk about the Meissner effect, which is on page 338, where it talks about the complete expulsion of magnetic flux. I don't think that zero resistance, well, I know that zero resistance is not the same concept as excluding all magnetic field lines from the material, but somehow they go hand in hand. Like I say, they're different ideas. Zero resistance is zero resistance, and expelling magnetic fields is a different thing. It's not the same idea, but they happen together. When the object goes superconducting, it expels all magnetic fields, which is why we get pictures like figure 1029, and I think I sent a movie out to, was that the other class, or did I send it to Modern Physics too? You got it twice. Okay, so you saw the little, was it YouTube? I don't remember where it was, but some video on the web of the floating magnets. The floating magnet works on the Meissner effect principle, that if the superconductor expels all of the magnetic fields, and you had a magnet sitting on top of your superconductor, well, that magnetic field can't just disappear. It still kind of, you know, bends around from the North Pole to the South Pole, and if it can't go down into the superconducting material beneath it, then it has to lift up so the field can fit between them, because the field can't go in the superconductor. And so that's the whole cause of the magnetic levitation. It's floating on the magnetic field because the field lines cannot penetrate the superconductor. It's pretty cool stuff. It's important to realize when I emphasize that superconducting stuff, superconductivity is not an extension of regular conductivity, because things that you normally think of as the best conductors, like gold and silver and, you know, some of those metals in there, are not necessarily good superconductors. In fact, platinum, that very case. Platinum's a nice, good metal, but it doesn't become a superconductor. So copper, silver, and gold, three of the four best conductors at room temperature, are not superconductors. The best conductors make the worst superconductors, it says. So that's another indication that they're different phenomena. And in fact, as it talks later in the section, starts talking about it on page 344, search for higher temperatures, that these new types of superconductors found in the 1980s and then later, 1986, I guess is when they first popped up, to be even up to liquid nitrogen temperatures, that as amazing as it seems, these are normally at regular room temperatures, ceramics, which we usually think of as being total insulators. So an insulator at room temperature can be a superconductor at low temperatures. I love this graph in figure 1035, which is a function of time across the bottom, and then the temperature, this critical temperature of the materials that we've discovered that are superconducting. You know, it goes clear back to 1911, but you had to go down to 4 Kelvin to get something to be superconducting. But you can see that as time goes on, we discovered more and more elements and alloys that were superconductors. But it was kind of a long, slow, shallow slope process, so that by 1985, we'd still only made it up to about, 20 Kelvin or so, as far as, you know, what's the highest temperature you could have something be superconducting, you know, different materials at different temperatures, but the best one, the highest temperature, looked like it's only about maybe 20 or 30 Kelvin in 1985. And then all of a sudden, made big news, by the way, I remember this, I was in grad school in Texas, and splash across the headlines, new high-temperature superconductors, and they were discovering them in a rapid succession. So look at the slope of that graph as it hockey sticks upward really fast right there in the late 80s. It's leveled off again since then, and it's not up to room temperature yet. But there was wild speculation then, as if that slope had kept up at its almost vertical pace, it wouldn't have been long, if it kept up, that we would have found room temperature superconductors. And then think what you could do. Then you wouldn't have to cool all the power lines from Delta to L.A., with liquid nitrogen, they'd just be superconducting at regular temperatures. And boy, would that save everybody a lot of money. So it was a heady time. It was very exciting, very interesting to keep watching the news and new ceramics that became semiconductors at fairly high temperatures. It was actually a breakthrough to find one at 77 Kelvin, because that is liquid nitrogen temperature, and liquid nitrogen is cheap. To go down to liquid helium temperatures requires extensive, advanced, expensive cryogenic techniques to get down to liquid helium 4 Kelvin. That's expensive and difficult. But liquid nitrogen is actually really easy to make and really cheap to make. And so it's kind of a magic temperature that, if we can make them at liquid nitrogen temperatures, maybe we can start to make some more practical applications with them. So that was the hope, and that was the glory of the 77 Kelvin.
What happened that year? Were they just researching something and then stumbled upon it, or how come?
I think it was kind of serendipity, kind of stumbled across it. They had some ideas, but notice the chemical formulas in Table 10.7 of these ceramics. The ones prior really weren't ceramics. You've got just elements and then alloys and then some intermetallic stuff in there with some variable formulas in there, but notice the first one in 86, the barium lanthanum copper oxide, has X's and Y's in it, which means that those are variables. You can actually have, you're not talking about individual molecules, you can't have a variable number of atoms in one molecule, but in a solid large-scale structure, you can vary the ratio or the percentages of barium and lanthanum in there, and whatever lanthanum you don't have, you have to make up for with barium. That's, you have X on the barium and 5 minus X on the lanthanum. It's kind of an interesting new type of material, and you can vary the formula a little bit and still have it be superconducting. But these are clearly different, so they kind of stumbled on them. It's a real breakthrough in 86. These are easy, very easy to make, actually, though. Even though they look like interesting formulas, look at the one in 1987, the yttrium barium copper oxide. That's the one, I think I mentioned it to my other physics class. When I was in Texas as a graduate student, I was a TA for the senior level physics lab class. And they basically had to do one giganto experiment for the whole semester, like measure the speed of light, which you can't do anymore because it's now defined, or do the Compton effect, you know, take the real data. But right after 87, it all of a sudden became very popular. Those students wanted to make superconductors, and so they'd work on that for a semester. Now you say, oh, if it's a whole semester long, that might be a hard project. There's some little techniques you need to refine, but it's really not that tough. You just get the chemicals together and smash them into a little pellet, and then you bake it in a kiln for, you know, 900 degrees and leave it for a couple of weeks and come back, and it's a superconductor. If you immerse it in liquid nitrogen, it's not a superconductor at room temperature. Looks like a ceramic disc, but if you do like here and pour it in a little pot of liquid nitrogen, then you can float magnets on it. It's not that hard. Now, you might say, what might you say? Why don't we...
That's what I was going to say. It was a long time ago, and I forgot. I wish I could remember, because if I remember, it was bugging me, and then my mind went somewhere else.
Well, maybe I'll trigger it back again. You might say, why can't we make any kind of magnetic field we want to and levitate things easily with just one little superconducting wire? Maybe it costs a lot of money to cool one wire to, or a bunch of wires to 77 Kelvin, but just do with one wire, run all the current through it. The answer is that superconductors have a critical temperature above which they are no longer superconducting. That's T sub C. But they also have a critical magnetic field, and that you might say, oh, dang, this kind of ruins the shine on this for me. Maybe they're not so cool after all. They're still really, really cool. But if you think about it, this only makes logical sense, too. There's a critical magnetic field that if you exceed that, it's not superconducting either. And so you can't just run any current you want through your magnetic, through your superconducting wire, because that current creates a magnetic field. And if you exceed the critical field, then it's not superconducting anymore. So you can't have infinite current densities in superconductors.
Do you know that I had to take your AC current?
You don't get stuff for free. It's still cool, but there's a critical current density which corresponds to the critical field. And then you see this graph, figure 1030, combines those two things. The critical temperature is on there as the field goes to zero. But take the lead one, for example. Its critical temperature looks like about 7.2 Kelvin. But in the presence of a magnetic field, you'd have to get it colder to keep it superconducting. So, you know, at 0.06 Tesla, you'd have to lower its temperature down to, what, 4 Kelvin in order to keep it superconducting.
Those ranges, what do those depend on? Like, wouldn't you just have one critical temperature? Is it once you get there, it's there, and then on the way up, if you get here, it's on either side?
No, there is only one critical critical temperature, but as we've discussed it heretofore, we assumed zero magnetic field was lying around. This is indicating that in the presence of a magnetic field, critical temperature is different, and it's actually colder the stronger the magnetic field. So to keep it superconducting, you'd have to cool it colder in order for it to stay superconducting. Superconducting, of course, is underneath the graph, and the non-superconductings above.
I have a silly little question.
Where are you looking?
In table 10.7 on page 344, those funny chemical formulas that we looked at for the ceramics have some variables in them, which means you have a range of ratios. Miles asks why some of those are X's and Y's and some are deltas.
See, that's where the ranges I was talking about. Is there a TC or there's a range?
Oh, well, that's what you're talking about.
I'm sorry, I wasn't on the same page as you.
Oh.
Is it maybe just a different... Because I was thinking maybe it would go with those X's and different X's, but those don't even go with those ones.
I don't know. I don't know that this table has magnetic field accounted for. And if not, then I'm not sure what the range corresponds to. And one thought was, well, maybe that's their uncertainty, but I doubt that too. I'm sure they would know that by now to a better certainty, better precision than that. So I don't know.
And then, do they just kind of make them? Like, they're trying to make, like, using chemistry and stuff, they're just trying to make some.
They kind of stumbled on them first in 86, but since then, as they try to explain these, they have some idea kind of how they work, and so they try to engineer new materials to be superconductors with moderate success. They talk about different planes in the ceramic made up of different chemical elements, like the barium and the lanthanum might be in this plane, and then the copper and the oxygen might be in the next plane, and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And so they think that might be related to how they work, and so they substitute in one element for one of those, but still keep the overall general structure the same, but substitute stuff and see if something works better than something else. So it's not totally shooting in the dark. They're trying to engineer these. But frankly, at least as far as I know, we don't understand these new high-temperature superconductors very well at a theoretical level, so we don't understand the guiding principles. They actually seem to be working on a different basis than the old lower-temperature traditional superconductors, which are quite well explained by the BCS theory, but the BCS theory is inadequate for these. And so consequently, not understanding or not having a good explanatory theory limits your ability to engineer materials if you don't understand them. So it's kind of still a little bit hit and miss, trial and error stuff.
And it just occurred to me, I was like, well, why haven't they just stumbled across, like, it seems funny just to make one, because you'd think if there was something out there room temperature, we'd have found it by now.
Well, there's a lot of ways to combine 100 elements,
yeah.
Zillions. I mean, you can have all kinds of different formulas, different subscripts. So I'm sure there are many, many more combinations to try. But the longer we go without finding one, I guess maybe the more discouraged you might get. This is really exciting in 86, 87, 88, because, you know, every few weeks you'd see a new announcement. You know, I've raised the critical temperature on, you know, the new material is 10 degrees higher critical temperature than the old one or whatever. There's a lot of speculation that it was only a matter of time before we found a room temperature superconductor. But it's been 20 years and still nothing. This graph only goes to 94, doesn't it?
Who did our night books say they were up to, like, 150 or something?
I
think it said somewhere.
Oh, did it say? Yeah, maybe.
I haven't been through that now.
They could easily have discovered some since 90. This says at the bottom of the caption, as of 99... there had been no further significant increases since 93, so it actually leveled off flat after this last dot, clear up to the end of the century, 99. But maybe Knight's got new information. In fact, that's easily something that I wouldn't have to search the web for. Any of you could easily do that. Search for high-temperature superconductors, and I'm sure you'd be able to find out what the material is that gives us the highest critical temperature now. One more comment about ceramics. While we're so happy to have something that's above liquid nitrogen temperature, you also have to think about a ceramic in terms of its physical properties. What do you usually want to make solenoids out of? Well, wires. What do you usually want to make wires out of? Materials that are malleable and ductile. Malleable means you can hammer it thin, and ductile means you can draw it into a wire. And metals are wonderful because they are malleable and ductile. Can you imagine pulling on a ceramic and hoping it stretches out into a wire? Making wires out of these new high-temperature superconductors is a whole new engineering challenge. And so you don't just get a bulk mass and draw it out as you would a metal. Instead, you have to build it from the ground up. And they don't usually try to do round wires. They usually try to do, like, flat strips with some thin thickness as your conducting path, because they can build those. Remember those planes of atoms I talked about? Those seem to be important for the superconducting process. So they try to leave the planes and make strips of conductor as the wires. But it's kind of interesting challenge. Well, I can't think of anything else to say. Can you ask any more questions?
Yeah. With the critical
magnetic field. Would it be that once it was over the critical magnetic field, the magnetic force on the electrons would be great enough to split up the Cooper pairs?
That might be an explanation.
Okay.
Whether it's critical temperature or critical field, it has to have something to do with splitting up those pairs. Okay. But still, I'm not knowledgeable enough about the new high-temperature superconductors to even know if they still talk about Cooper pairs. I don't think they do. There's some other mechanism. I don't understand it. But in the traditional superconductors, if you went above a critical temperature or a critical field and separated those pairs so they weren't associated with each other, you have a bunch of fermions that have to obey the Pauli exclusion principle, and then you have an ordinary material, which probably isn't even a fantastic conductor at all in a regular sense.
What would create the screening currents in the superconductors that create the flux that keeps it? Like, you got the flux from the magnet above that's trying to come down in, and there's a current inside the superconductor that creates a flux to repel it, basically. What would create those currents? Because there's no, like it said in here, there's no changing magnetic flux to create the currents. So it doesn't obey Lenz's law. Here on...
Is that where it's got the floating magnet?
Page 340. Well, it's the next page over. It's talking about it.
The Meissner effect may remind you of Lenz's law. Let's see, one might think that in a superconductor the current simply persists. This is not what happens. One can impose a constant magnetic field on the material above its TC, so initially there is no current. If the material is then cooled to below TC, the field is expelled, so pushed out. It doesn't get frozen in, it gets pushed out.
I was just wondering if like something's creating an electric field to cause the currents in there.
Google Meissner effect. Did you have some other questions? Maybe one I can answer.
several of you have already answered, but one of them was I didn't really understand this idea of a phonon. It's in the BCS theory on the next page. It talks about
phonons. You see the O-N ending that makes you think of a particle or a unit of stuff like proton, person, and all that stuff. Photon. But what does the first part of the word make you think of? Phone.
Yeah.
Or a phonograph, but you're too young to know about phonographs, so you only know about phones. What does that make you think of? Where does the root
light?
Phone come from? That's photon.
Sound, I guess.
Phonograph plays sound. So these are little quanta of sound. When we discussed waves back in chapter 21 last semester, what did we say about how does sound work? It's a longitudinal wave, but we talked about molecules vibrating and colliding with the next one and passing their energy on, right? From harmonic oscillator to harmonic oscillator. And that's a good way to think of it, but we thought of it classically, which meant we thought of it as having continuous amounts of energy available. You could have a sound wave of any energy you wanted to. But in quantum physics, everything's quantized. There's the smallest possible amount of energy you can have in systems. And so you want to think of lattice vibrations as very akin to sound waves in air, only it's now in a solid. But phonon is, it's not just coincident that they picked those letters. They really picked this because it's related to sound. These are sound vibrations in the lattice, and they're quanta of the sound energy field, and so we think of them as ons, as particles. Now let me sidetrack totally completely and totally leave superconductivity for a minute and then come back around and tie that back in again. Because one thing I would like for us to understand, and I mentioned this before, this is a new way to teach quantum mechanics, but the right way to teach quantum mechanics. And in fact, it'll help us through the rest of the book if we get this idea down. And I don't know that you would have been taught this idea in 20 or 30 years ago in a class like this. It's kind of a recent approach, but it's the right way to think about things. Photons are quanta of the electromagnetic field. Let me say that again and then discuss it. Photons are quanta of the electromagnetic field. So what you need to do is think about fields. In fact, I mentioned today in physics, I'd like you to come around to the idea that fields are not a mere mathematical crutch or modeling invention to help visualize. We've got to start thinking of fields as maybe not only real, but as possibly, I'm going to say it, the only reality. I've already said that?
We didn't get the fist bang the first time, though.
And you're hesitant to say it, too.
Fields are the only reality. And so when you think about light particles, you should think of them as the smallest possible fluctuations of the electromagnetic field. Particles, you remember the wave-particle duality? You got to stop thinking about particles as particles. They're always waves or something else, or even newer, or even better, rather than particles or waves, or even both, they're quanta of various fields. So when we get to the end of this book and we start talking about particle physics and unification of all the different forces of nature, we start talking about all the different bosons that become the force carrier particles. You have photons for the electromagnetic field, force carriers, and we have gluons for the strong force. They're the force carrier particles. And then we're going to have weak bosons for the weak force. They're the force carrier particles. But you've got to stop thinking of particles. In every case, the gluons are simply the quanta of the color field. Color field is what corresponds to the strong force. And the W bosons and the Z bosons, which carry the weak force, are really, you shouldn't think of them as little billiard balls. You should think of them as quanta, smallest possible chunks, of the weak field. And even gravity. We think of gravitational fields. If there's a field, then there's the smallest possible chunk. So we're eventually going to talk about gravitons.
So is there anything that physicists think isn't quantized?
I don't think there's anything that physicists haven't talked about being quantized. I don't know if we're sure about space and time. But there's even been articles written on quantized space and quantized time. I've even heard about chronons, which would be the quanta of the time field.
Chronos?
Yeah. Bring this discussion full circle then. Phonons are the quanta of this sound energy field. And it doesn't have to be a sound that humans can hear. It doesn't have to either be that loud or in our human range of hearing either. But the whole idea of sound that we talked about earlier is this vibration through material. In this case, it's a lattice, a solid thing. But you have lattice vibrations, and their smallest chunks are called phonons. Does that help at all?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it actually does a lot.
In fact, I'm going to go ahead and just expose my ignorance, because if I had an ego, I wouldn't admit so often that I have no clue what's going on. But I don't have an ego. So I'm going to tell you that it wasn't very long ago when I was even still teaching this class, like I say 5 or 6 years ago, even teaching this class, I never quite understood the connection between the discussion of the forces of nature in terms of these force carrier particles and general relativity, which talks about, you know, bent space-time. And how were we possibly going to unify the four forces of nature when we kept talking about relativity as bent space-time and these other three forces as exchanging force carrier particles? You know, the way two charges, two protons, charged particles, the way they repel each other is by throwing quanta of their field back and forth. They throw photons back and forth. That's how protons repel. So how do massive objects attract? They throw gravitons back and forth. But that didn't seem like the same kind of... Before I understood this quantum of the field idea, the idea of throwing particles back and forth, still I was thinking billiard balls, didn't have any connection in my mind to general relativity, where gravity is envisioned as curved space-time. But now it's starting to make sense to me, because I'm realizing we have to think about everything as fields, and all these force carrier particles aren't really particles, they're just the smallest chunks of energy of their respective fields. So if you have objects that feel the color charge, those would be quarks. then they throw gluons back and forth. But really, those gluons aren't little billiard balls. They're quanta of the color field. If you have two particles that have the weak charge, whatever you want to call that, that means they respond to the weak force or feel the weak force, that means they throw weak bosons back and forth. But you don't think of little billiard balls being thrown back and forth. You think of them as the smallest quantized chunks of the weak field. So all these fields exist around us. In fact, the universe is fields.
So electrons and protons and stuff, those are mass fields? Because they have mass? I don't know.
I'm going to put that one off till chapter 14, but it's a very good question. But we're really not prepared. It would take the rest of the day to do that one. It's a good question, though.
It's weird.
You can write it down and remember to ask it next time.
Which chapter?
Probably 14 or after. Any more quick questions from chapter 10 or superconductivity?
I have one quick question. That one might be easy. They say there isn't one application in Josephson junctions, and they talk about the squids or something.
Yeah.
So do those have to be then very, very cold?
Yes. Yeah, they have to cool those down to liquid nitrogen temperature.
Okay.
Yeah. But they're very cool instruments. They're not something you'd experience in daily life, but they're very useful in research labs. In fact, these other students will remember the day I told them a story that we're looking for magnetic monopoles in the universe, just an isolated north pole or an isolated south pole without an associated other half, kind of like a bare negative charge or a bare proton positive charge. We can't find those in nature as far as magnetism is concerned. Everything has both a north and a south pole. It's always a magnetic dipole. But some theories actually call for the existence of bare north poles, magnetic monopoles. And so I told them that we've been looking for them for 30 years, and we thought we found one on Valentine's Day in 1983. Squids is how they look for them. They expect that a magnetic monopole wandering through their squid would induce, Faraday's law comes in here, would induce a little tiny quantum current in the squid that they would be able to detect and see on their oscilloscope as a rise in voltage. And Josephson junctions may someday also become part of computers as a switching element. Transistors are what we make computers out of these days. But anything that has a dual state on-off sort of thing can be made into a computer, and we did that with vacuum tubes before we had transistors. So it's not that transistors are sacred, they just happen to be cheap and easy and scalable, and you can make zillions of them at a time, so we've used transistors to great effect. But Josephson junctions could also act as a switching element, and they would be faster if we could build them small enough and package them like we've done with transistors. They would be able to make faster computers because they're superconductive. You read about maglev, too. All right, I want to talk a little bit about chapter 11, or at least get us started in it. We're supposed to do part of chapter 11 today, but I think the DVD is also something we want to do today, too. So let's give a brief introduction to some of this stuff and then watch a little bit of this movie. I think it's pretty good, pretty educational on this semiconductor stuff. Band theory. Who would like to venture a explanation of band theory?
Band theory?
That's where you play saxophones and tubas, right?
Mm-hmm. I remember how to do so much in
the first. It does.
I was going to remember it so that I could have something to say, and now I've forgotten.
I think I mentioned it once before in that everything, all bets are off when we studied the hydrogen atom as a single potential well, and we got discrete energy levels spaced by n squared and all this stuff, that if you put two hydrogen atoms next to each other, the wave functions have to overlap if they're close enough. If you have three, then the wave functions interact, and it gets very complicated.
It explains why it's like differences between semiconductors and conductors.
It does. Mm-hmm.
And semiconductors, when they get colder, their resistivity actually goes up instead of going to some...
So now we're ready to look at figure 11.1 on page 363 and look at part C of the figure. We've already looked at part A and B earlier in our discussion of superconductivity. At part C, it's a semiconductor, and you notice that it totally curves the other way. But this isn't new either, actually, because this is exactly the shape of the curve you used in lab the day you did the cranking on the cylinder with the can of sand hanging from the cord. How did you measure the temperature of your aluminum cylinder? You stuck an ohm meter on there, remember? It was this graph right here. If you knew the resistance, you knew the temperature. And it was a semiconductor resistor in there. It's called a thermistor. This was exactly the shape of the curve. If you remember that classroom set of sheets I gave you that had the curve on it so you could look up your temperatures, that was it. When you normally think of conductivity, you think, oh, as it gets colder, the resistance goes down, like in Sprott's jumping ring video. But clearly, that's not the case for semiconductors. To get a running leap at the band theory, I want to emphasize the idea that we know quantum mechanics for a single hydrogen atom. We spent chapter 6 and 7 developing it. And we know about wave functions and leaking into the walls of the barriers if they're finitely high and all that stuff. And that's all well and good for a single hydrogen atom. But the point is that in most things, you don't have one single hydrogen atom, especially in solids, you don't. So you have the nucleus that's kind of making a three-dimensional, it's hard to visualize this, we tried last time, or many times ago, you've got to visualize a three-dimensional well plus a fourth dimension to indicate the depth of the well, you know, how the potential. Three spatial dimensions, but a fourth representing how deep it is. Each nucleus is going to do that, and so the electrons around that nucleus have a Schrodinger wave function, solution to the wave equation, but if there are two of them close to each other, then the wave functions kind of meld together and they modify each other, and it's not the same old wave function that you know and loved, and therefore the allowed energies can be altered. And if you have 3 or 4 or 5 or 11 of these lined up in a row, different potential wells, then the electrons in there would have significantly different chances for energy levels to be in. In fact, after you've paid good attention to figure 11.2 to see how wave functions might combine, flip over to figure 11.3 on page 364 and see these two graphs here, A and B, showing that, you know, two hydrogen atoms next to each other, or in part B, 11 of them next to each other. What you see here is that what you used to think of as just the 1s energy level or the 2s energy level, now, because there's 11 of them all close together and modifying and interfering with each other, and in fact, if you want to, you can think of the whole thing as a system, not 11 individual wave functions, but a wave function of 11 electrons that has to all make sense and have the derivatives all match and everything. What it gives you is this kind of continuous bands almost, this 11-way splitting of the energy levels, and you're not going to stop at 11. In any real material, a real solid substance, any real crystalline stuff, you're not going to have 11 atoms, you're going to have 11 gazillion atoms. And so those structures that look like just 11 splits actually become split gazillionly to the point where they're practically continuous. Now, in some sense, we still believe in quantized things, and it's not maybe truly continuous, but close enough, and I really mean that, close enough. You can now talk about energy bands rather than energy levels, and that's the whole idea of band theory of solids. If you understand that one idea, well, let me take you through one more little comment. At the bottom of that page, figure 11.4, I should be showing these on the computer since I have them available. Those are the potential wells, and they're finitely high. So you'd have to go back to our finite potential well wave functions that leak in to the walls, and then they'd interfere with the other ones. Anyway, that's the idea. They lead you through the math there. But what I really want you to concentrate on, and if you understand the next figure, then I'm good. In fact, this is probably as far as we really need to go today, is figure 11.6. And you probably looked at it, but it's really the whole crux of the whole issue. Figure 11.6 tells you why insulators are insulators, it tells you why conductors are conductors, and it tells you why and how semiconductors are semiconductors. So I'm just going to actually shut my trap for 30 to 60 seconds and let you just stare intently at figure 11.6, and then you can even talk about it if you want to each other.